Mr. O'Neill.
May it please the court. My name is William O'Neill, and I represent the defendant appellant, Mr. Parker. I intend to address three issues with you, and we raised four in our brief, and I'm willing to stand on our brief on the fourth issue regarding the imposition of supervised release. I would like to begin today with the speedy trial violation that occurred. There's no dispute as between the government and Mr. Parker regarding 64 days of the 70 necessary, and there's 16 additional days which I believe were not excludable and that passed, and those are occurred in two periods. The first is an 11-day period, and this relates to when the speedy trial clock began to run. We believe the speedy trial clock began on October 20th, the day Mr. Parker first appeared before the magistrate judge. The government argues that it should begin on November 1st. There's an 11-day window there, and I believe the case law is clear and the act is clear that the act, I'll read for you, says the trial shall commence within 70 days from the filing date or making public of the information or indictment or from the date the defendant has appeared before a judicial officer of the court in which such charge is pending, whichever date last occurs.
So it's your position that if Congress had meant to say the date of arraignment, they would have said that, not the date appeared.
That is correct, Your Honor.
In a nutshell. Are there any cases, which cases are you relying on for that interpretation of the statute?
I believe the Henderson case, Your Honor, supports this. It says the speedy trial clock begins on, quote, the last indictment, information, or appearance, and it cites the act.
We're not worrying about that, though, because here we have the appearance coming after the indictment, right?
Right.
This case really gets down to that, right? Because there's no finding that Judge Sharp made that might have said, in the interest of justice, I'm extending the clock in any fashion.
That is correct.
Yeah.
And we believe this case on those 11 days is distinguishable from the court's language in Larson, Garrett, and Baskin Bay, where in dicta the court said it begins on arraignment. But we believe that was general language, not intended to draw a distinction that the government would like to draw here. In those cases,
does the record show that arraignment and first appearance were synonymous in those cases?
Often
that'll be the case, right?
My review of the opinions, it's not 100% clear, but those cases either cite to the act or they cite to Henderson. And in Henderson, it is clear that the last defendant appeared and was arraigned on the same day. So I believe Larson, Baskin Bay, and Garrett did not intend to draw that distinction. It just so happened in those three cases that arraignment and the first appearance occurred on the same day.
Well, even assuming your interpretation of the statute is the correct one on the face of the statute, isn't that same 11-day time period excluded because of the government's motion for detention, which everyone seems to have overlooked? And motions, the time of pendency of motions is also excluded pursuant to a different subsection of the Speedy Trial Act, and the parties mentioned several motions that were pending during the course of this period of time before your client was brought to trial, but the detention motion is never mentioned other than the fact that it was made, and it was made on the day of his first appearance, and it was put over and not decided until, I guess it was November 1st at the time that arraignment actually occurred. So that same 11-day time period is excluded pursuant to a different subsection of the statute anyway.
Your Honor, I would argue that the government has conceded as much that is not excludable.
I didn't see that concession in the government's brief. Everybody seems to have overlooked it, but I didn't see a concession on that. I think everyone is in agreement that the time that the judge was out for medical reasons is not excludable under any of the subsections of the Speedy Trial Act because the judge didn't make the appropriate findings. But everyone agreed that all time periods during which motions were pending should be excluded and just forgot about this particular motion.
Well, there's an additional period, Your Honor, that I would like to also address. And that's the 5 days that relate to the government's motion to allow a law student to participate in the trial. I believe those 5 days also are not excludable because they do not, as pursuant to the statutory language, relate to, they're not, quote, concerning the defendant, end quote, which the act requires. And the government's support for the position that those 5 days should be excludable is the Hemmings case, which I believe is completely unpersuasive, Your Honors. It involved 30 days while the court took a motion in limine under consideration. It did not involve a motion to allow a law student to participate in trial.
Could the judge have excluded the time when he was ill?
The judge could have if he made specific findings on the records, which did not occur.
Should he have made? What findings?
That the interest of justice, Mr. Parker would not suffer prejudice as a result of the delay. I believe are the findings that he would have to make, Your Honor.
Well, isn't it pretty obvious that he would have made those findings?
Well, I don't know that he would have, Your Honor. In reviewing
Under Zedner, doesn't it not make any difference? The Supreme Court just held in Zedner that without the findings, there's no harmless error rule for this statute.
I'll be happy to try to look at that, Your Honor.
Well, it's a Supreme Court decision decided June 5th, 2006.
Okay.
Unanimous on this point.
The next argument I'd like to address is the multiplicity of Mr. Parker's convictions. The only issue here is, was it plain error to force Mr. Parker to go through the rest of his life with a second conviction for possession of a firearm on his record? And congressional intent is clear that Congress did not intend to punish two times for a same 922G offense. And we believe this is error that needs to be reversed. And the government would have you believe this additional conviction is simply harmless. And that isn't the case. When you look at the Supreme Court's precedent in Ball versus United States, Justice Berger articulated that the second conviction does not evaporate simply because of the concurrence of the sentence, and it cannot be ignored. And I know this court, including several justices today,
judges,
thank you, have differed on this opinion, but I believe those cases, and they are Baldwin and McCarter, are both factually distinguishable from this case and are difficult to reconcile with the Supreme Court's decision in Ball and the Supreme Court's decision in Rutledge.
Now, your position about Rutledge, as I understand it, is that one can infer from the court's account of what went on that that had been a forfeited point in the lower courts and the court nonetheless thought it important enough. There's no particular discussion of the plain error standards in Rutledge, is there? Not that I recall. Because that's the difference. I'm not sure anybody's disagreeing with the fundamental proposition, is it a mistake?
Right.
There are a lot of mistakes. But then the next question is on plain error review, do we need to do something about that mistake? And I understood your argument to be that in Rutledge, in fact, it was also functionally a forfeited point in the lower court, and the Supreme Court did say, yes, you do need to do something about it.
That's correct.
Okay.
And I believe also when you look at this court's prior jurisprudence in United States versus Podell, a 1989 decision, that there they held that multiple sentences were a miscarriage of justice and constituted plain error. It's not the same set of factual circumstances, but if you want to look outside the circuit to the First Circuit in United States.
You should make a different argument that in the ordinary plain error case, the problem is that you don't want to have a retrial when the defendant had failed to notice the mistake because, you know, it's a big expense and so on. But here, to correct this error, right, would be completely painless, no further proceeding, right?
That's correct.
There isn't any reason why to be fussy about the... Isn't that what the real point?
That is correct, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. O'Neill. Mr. Barrett?
May it please the court.
So taking the last point first, it's an illegal sentence. Why not just strike it, right?
I think the reason for it is that this court's precedent in
There's no reason, right? There's no reason to keep an illegal sentence in force, which, as he said, could come back and bite this person in the future as he when he resumes his life of crime. So,
well, I think the responses are twofold. First, that's not the law of this circuit.
How about the sense of it, right? As I said, The plain error standard, it makes a lot of sense because you don't want to have retrials and retrials and retrials just because the defendant's lawyer failed to notice something, right? But in this case, that no further proceedings are necessary to correct this error. It's correctable costlessly. So what reason can there be not to correct it?
It is the case that this wouldn't correction of the error would certainly not require a retrial, but simply a resentencing.
Not even a resentencing, it's fixing the paper. It deletes the one sentence and refunds either the 100 or the 300, depending on what the special assessment was at the time.
Well, then I guess the question becomes, what is the reason for the plain error standard? Is the reason really that we don't want to go back and do more trials?
The reason is, if the reason isn't judicial economy of some sort, or, you know, putting pressure on defendants, counsel, not to waste time by bringing up the error seriatim, that's the purpose. How would that purpose be served by invoking the rule in this case?
I'm not sure I'd be willing to concede that that is the sole purpose
of
the plain error.
What is another purpose?
I think another purpose is a finality in a judicial decision. And if there becomes an exception to the plain error doctrine, which is that plain error applies,
except when it's... Because this case isn't final yet, right? Because it's on appeal.
Well, it was
final. It's not like he's coming back in 10 years and trying to...
Insofar as the district court is concerned, though, it was final.
Well, it's the same thing for errors that are preserved. There's the same degree of finality to things he objected to as things he didn't object to. It's on direct appeal.
It is the case that correcting this error does not implicate the judicial economy question. I think the question then before the court is there an exception to the plain error doctrine for corrections that don't implicate judicial economy issues? As to the Speedy Trial Act question, it is the case, as the court pointed out, that this court could find for the government on the Speedy Trial Act in two ways. First, it could say that the case law of this circuit, which says that the speedy trial clock begins at arraignment, means speedy.
No, but it doesn't. That's not the only thing this court has said. This court has a decision from around 1987 or so, I'm not going to pronounce it right, Owor Conirin, in which we specifically reject the idea that arraignment is the significant event, because there was first appearance, then there was the indictment, then there was an arraignment, and the government tried to argue that the clock ran from the arraignment, and as it happened, the later date was the indictment, because first appearance had already happened. And so Owor Conirin is actually squarely against you on that point.
Well, then in that case, I think we would rely on the argument that the court has raised, that the time between the initial appearance and the arraignment should nonetheless be excluded because there was a pending government motion.
Why haven't you forfeited that point?
Your Honor, we focused on the arraignment point.
That's my question, is why haven't you forfeited the alternative ground, even if it would have been proper?
It is the case that we didn't raise that argument in our opening brief. So if the court finds that we have forfeited that argument and that the clock begins on initial appearance and not arraignment, then there is a Speedy Trial Act problem. As to the 5 days during which the government's motion to allow the law student to participate was pending, I think the case law is fairly clear that a motion in the defendant's own case, whether or not filed by the defendant or the government, tolls the clock. I mean, this isn't even an instance.
Why does that matter anyway? It just gets you up to 69.
Right. I was addressing the point.
Yeah, I'm not sure that's... Unless there's another day somewhere or two, I'm not sure we need to worry about that. I mean, the problem is, I suppose, there's a risk of the government throwing in all sorts of motions solely for its own convenience and getting infinite extensions of the time and thereby defeating Congress's intent that criminal defendants have a right to a speedy trial.
Right.
I mean, there's no harmless error. The Zedner case, which I think is too bad the parties didn't discuss, is quite clear that this is supposed to be a very technical statute, one which is enforced to the letter.
And we cited Zedner in our response brief and acknowledged that the H-8 order was not made, therefore the time when Judge Sharp was sick and unavailable cannot be excluded under the Zedner, right. Zedner precedent. Unless the court has further questions, I think that's all I have.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Barrett. Mr. O'Neill, do you have anything further?
Briefly, Your Honor, on the multiplicity point, during our discussion, we've presumed that the plain error standard applies, and I would like to point out to the court that this may be a de novo finding. As we noted in footnote 1 of our reply brief, a multiplicitous sentence may be raised for the first time on appeal. Now, that has not been determined in this court, but several well-recognized practice guides and the Ninth Circuit, as well as the Fifth Circuit, have held that you may raise the multiplicitous sentence for the first time on appeal, while you cannot raise the multiplicitous indictment. That would be a plain error if you're contending the indictment was multiplicitous, but here we're contending only the sentence. So to address the government's point that if the standard is de novo, there's simply no reason not to correct the small clerical error. And the next thing I'd like to address is our third argument, which is ineffective assistance of counsel. And believe there's at least four.
I don't understand. How is that rebuttal? He didn't mention it. Did he?
I believe the government's position was under the plain error.
Did he argue that in his oral presentation, Mr. Barrett? Did he mention that?
The government argued that the plain error standard is so weighty that I understood his argument to be the plain error standard is so weighty that even under that standard, you couldn't make a simple clerical correction because it's not a substantial right.
What does that have to do with ineffective assistance of counsel?
My prior point was on the multiplicity, Your Honor.
What is ineffective assistance? Why are you bringing that? Why are you mentioning that?
That's the third argument Mr. Parker raises on appeal, and then I hope to address with you today.
No, but Mr. Barrett didn't mention it in his oral presentation. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Well, you're rebutting. You can't break your argument into two pieces, right? You can only use rebuttal for rebuttal.
We're happy to rely on the brief for that, Your Honor.
Okay, and you were appointed, weren't you? Okay, well, we thank you for your efforts on that.